Hello, Maven here. The following talk was delivered in front of a live audience by the academic agent Andrew Witten 2023, coinciding with the launch of his book, The Prophets of Doom. The rest of the videos from that year's conference are being released on our Shieldings Events YouTube channel, so please head over there to hear talks from the likes of Orin McIntyre and The Distributist, as well as our soon-to-be-released episodes of Unpopular Opinions Live. But most importantly, check out both the Witten 2025-themed Generations, taking place at the end of August in the Birmingham area, England, featuring Edward Dutton, Carl Benjamin, and the Raw Egg Nationalist. And, for the first time ever, we're hosting an Australian conference, the First Fleet Forum, taking place at the end of October in the Sydney area, Down Under, featuring Carl Benjamin again, Tom Rotel, better known as Survive the Jive, Russell Water, and Dr. Frank Salter. These are the premier intellectual conferences for those on the right, and they are not to be missed. Tickets for both events are available now on our website, linked in the description, and we are accepting pitches for both if you would like to present alongside our esteemed headline speakers. Make sure to check out both the website and our channel, and then enjoy AA's talk from 2023, titled 10 Lessons from Cyclical History.
All right, as various stragglers come in, I'll make a start in the interest of time. My name is Nima Parvini, if you didn't know. And today I want to share with you something that's based on the concluding chapter of The Prophets of Doom. Buy it now. Grateful for a lot of those of you who've actually done that already today. But I'm going to make some significant kind of elaborations and insertions that I don't go into in the book, aka stuff that was too base to say in the book that I'll say in this room. I'll also just mention that if you don't know who the Prophets of Doom are, there are these nine characters here. For those of you who are not familiar, there's Vico, Gobineau, Carlyle, Brooks Adams, who everybody should read because he's much lesser known than some of these others. Spengler, of course, glowering in the middle. Sorokin, Arnold Toynbee, who I like to describe as, polite Spengler with a cup of tea and a vicar type, which is kind of true. John Baggett Glubb, extraordinary gentleman. And of course, Julius Evola. There are two other prophets of doom who are still living, which are Joseph Tainter and Peter Turchin. I didn't put them on the front of the book, partly because they're still living and therefore less based, but also because I didn't want to get into like problems with like, hello, can we use your picture on the front of the book type stuff. So it's those 11, okay? Now, having considered these 11 thinkers, it strikes me that despite many differences among them, there are numerous observations that recur very often in their thought. Now, since most of these prophets of doom were largely ignorant of each other, and since those who were not, i.e., for example, Toynbee was aware of Spengler, well, if you're aware of Spengler, as an academic, what you have to do is spend all your time saying, here's how I'm not Spengler and here's what's new. You know, that's what academics do. Basically, the ones who are aware of each other, they try to distinguish themselves from each other. But what I'm trying to do is to draw their convergences together. And I think that where they converge, I think it's safe to assume that they're talking about some aspect of the truth, because it's being recognized independently by different observers. They're all, through their various studies, coming up with the same thing again and again. So I'm going to go through the 10 most prominent of these. And then I'm going to want to try to leave some time for Q&A. So I'll see how we go after that. Okay, so the first of these is the spark, the animating spirit of the early warrior caste is distinct from the religion that comes to predominate and maintain the later multi-ethnic empire, which I will call the Imperial Altar. Now, I should make you aware that these terms, the spark and the Imperial Altar, are terms that I have made up. They don't actually occur anywhere in any of the thinkers, but these are kind of shorthand names I'm giving to these phenomena. And because this is a quite unusual point, I'm going to spend a bit longer on this one because I think it's quite important. Earlier in the book, I share a paper by Peter Turchin, which quantifies this point. It shows that what they have called big gods developed chiefly as a political technology to maintain a multi-ethnic empire. Now, incidentally, this was noted by the elite theorist Mosca in 1895, and you may be familiar with him from Populist Delusion. In other words, universalizing, moralizing religions, what Toynbee called universal churches, which recall for Toynbee is a late civilizational development, are the products themselves of complex societies. Now, why is this important? It's important because the contrary has been maintained by many scholars. Their claim is that these universalizing social technologies are in themselves the driving engines of the civilization. Now, we have seen throughout this study, you'll have to go and read it, again and again from multiple authors that almost every civilization or empire has started not with a moralizing universal church, but instead with a bursting out of a barbarian group of the Bronze Age variety, who most people would think of as primitive, Genghis Khan. Now, these barbarian groups had religions themselves, which helped to animate them in their spirit, in their zeal, in the great bursting forth. But these religions were not of the moralizing and universalizing stripe. These were people who practically believed in magic. It is the wide and the awestruck eyes at the lightning bolt described by Vico. Vico talks about these barbarian men who look at thunder and lightning and they're like, why? You know, they really believe it's magic in a way that those of us who grew up watching Ghostbusters never could, okay? Relax, man, I'm a scientist, etc. So it's that, or it's the Brooks Adams describes the age of fear. This is the fear that he's talking about, the genuine fear of magic that you have with these sorts of people. Now, as we saw in Evola, these people of the spark embodied a crude approximation of what he has called the solar masculine energy, a kind of vitality. And for such men, their religion is not universalist, but necessarily, regardless of what their actual books and doctrines say, they become particularist because these men can embody nothing else. It is the battle of friend against enemy, in-group versus out-group, crusade versus jihad. And this is the, I'm going to try to butcher this Arabic, asabaya described by Ibn Khaldun and modeled later by Peter Turchin. Now, the lunar feminine petty moralizing of the bourgeois variety against which the likes of Julius Evola revolted, you know, his revolt against the modern world is as much a revolt against this bourgeois kind of spirit that he's talking about. Like Nietzsche before him, this represents quite a different strain of religion. what Turchin and his collaborators have called Big God, which is also vital. It is used to consolidate the gains made by the men of the first stripe. Now, Evola call this kind of religion exterior or exoteric. Toynbee used a different phrase. He called it the ephemeral institution or the merely temporal, right? Or as Gobineau argued, he's the most forceful of the authors to argue this point, such a universal religion may help to maintain a civilization for a time, but it certainly cannot save it from collapse after the original animating spirit of the early phase is a distant memory. Since the universal religion was not the ultimate cause of the civilization, that cause being the animating spirit, the spark, the strength, and the asabaya of the founding elite, as this recent research by Turchin and others have shown, it cannot be expected to act as its savior, because as a political technology, it's doing something else. Now, to deal in concrete terms, this is the difference between the Mongols and the Golden Horde, or the early Arab conquests, by which I mean actual Muhammad and his original followers, and something like the Umayyad Caliphate, or the conquest of Charlemagne and what later became the Holy Roman Empire. The raiders of the early period must embody a heroic spirit, while the rulers of the later period have different, they've got a different set of problems. They've got problems of law and order and social cohesion to solve. Now, if the raiders had conquered vast swathes of territory comprising disparate peoples who spoke different languages and practiced different religions, one might then see how the need for the political technology of the universal religion might then become an imperative. This is a very interesting thing. I mean, and you can actually look at the way that the Mongols used, like they didn't impose their own religion on all the places they took over. They in fact used this political technology I'm talking about. Okay, so that's the first thing. You've got these two. Hands up if you have not understood the distinction between the spark and the imperial altar. Good, nobody, we can move on. Okay. So number two, civilizational successes such as conquest, wealth, and education generate their own loss conditions. Now, I believe it was the notorious B.I.G. who once said, featuring Puff Daddy and Mace, he said, more money, more problems. He actually said, mo money, mo problems, and I've anglicized it, but one of the issues with prosperity is that it generates intellectualism, a certain idealism and humanitarianism. It generates robust education systems and so on. And then it mistakes those effects for causes. It's like saying, I don't know, the British Empire came about because of great universities or something. I mean, clearly that's bullshit and everybody knows it. The true cause, the root cause, is always conquest in the first analysis. But as the people get richer, their taste for violence reduces. And they forget that order is based ultimately on force. Now, in elite theory terms, we get a circulation from lions to foxes. And this also happens historically. So a point that Vico makes, for example, is that we tend to remember the Greeks for Socrates and Plato as being what made them great. But in fact, Socrates and Plato were the decadent aftermath of greatness, which is captured in Homer. And paradoxically, it was Socrates directly, he was directly responsible, therefore, for the downfall of Greek civilization because of what Vico calls the barbarism of reflection. You know, you need to, rather than thinking of Socrates as like the founder of the Western civilization or something, it's better to think of him as like a kind of Greek Richard Dawkins or something like this, you know, right? The pattern is noted by almost all of the cyclical theorists. And this is something you'll find. Each of them, apart from Sorokin, who's a bit weird, have a negative opinion of Socrates because they understood the true meaning of Homer, who counterintuitively see the rise of intellectuals as a sign the decline is about to accelerate. And this brings us to the third point, which is that the barbarism of reflection destroys the foundations of the imperial altar and successfully kills any last remnants of the spark. Now, the advent of intellectuals is a double tragedy. First, because the imperial altar, which comes about, recall, to hold an empire together, that is weakened. And second, because the attacks by intellectuals on the imperial altar produce an even worse tragedy, which is conservatives. Because conservatives mistake the imperial altar as the cause of civilizational greatness rather than the effect of it. And they seek to preserve and uphold that rather than the actual cause. So you can see, I mean, that once you understand this, you understand why conservatives are always losers, because they are trying to, they've got a wrong thesis, basically, of what's happening. Now, the spark, so paradoxically, because the conservatives put all their energy into trying to maintain the imperial altar to help Hank Hill grill or whatever. Because they put all their energy into that, the spark, the original spark, also dims and fades and becomes almost entirely lost. The spark is diminished by both intellectuals and conservatives. The advent of conservatives in a civilization is almost always a bad sign because they are committed to dying rather than growing. And under Spengler's principle, that which is not growing is dying. An empire that is seeking to preserve and maintain rather than to expand is already dead. And I think the most recent and easiest example to see this with is actually the British Empire. You know, as soon as you get these, you know, the equivalent of the, like Mill and, you know, the ones, as soon as you get the kind of modern liberals, you then also get the invention of the conservative, and it's basically, I mean, from there to Churchill is not that far. Churchill being the absolute worst of said conservatives. Okay, fourth, the cast of the lion archetype, that is the warriors and the peasants, have mutual antagonisms with the cast of the fox archetype, that is the priests, or the intellectuals and the merchants. Okay, so this is another reoccurring trope, is that you get these four basic classes, and they split in this way. And Spengler, in particular, talks about this quite a lot: the special connection between the warrior caste and the peasant caste, because they have similar sensibilities. And also the intellectuals and the merchants, even though they may also have antagonisms across them, as well. Like, for example, you know, Aquinas. I'm going to rank all the people in society, and the merchants are right at the bottom. And why did Aquinas do that? In elite theory terms, what was he up to? He wanted to keep them. Didn't want the merchants to dislodge the priesthood as an important elite strata. Now, this is self-explanatory, but it's worth noting that the various ways in which the four basic castes combine is important, because it strikes me that even though you may have one ruling caste, they always buddy up in different ways across history. In the early period of a civilization, the spark is always set off by the warrior type, who establishes order and brings about something like feudalism. And this, you can see it again and again. I've been reading this book on ancient Chinese history and their, you know, establishing feudalism in 300 BC or whatever. So you do see it over and over again. Spengler notes a natural affinity between the warrior type and the peasant type. They are both lions in spirit. But it is the two fox types that cause complications. The priests help to establish the aforementioned imperial altar, okay, which is, although lunar, is also necessary, because if they didn't do that, they wouldn't be able to maintain an empire. But if that priest class is given too much power, they will make the civilization more lunar, in Evola's terms. The merchants arise naturally from the safety and order established by the warriors, as trade is a natural consequence of protected borders and a large peaceful area. And again, if we stick with the Mongols as the example, there was, once the Mongols had conquered that huge swathe of land, it was basically what we recognize today as a free trade zone, right? Which is kind of a bizarre thing. You think, well, Genghis Khan's responsible then for the rise of merchants later on, but this is how it goes again and again. Now, there can be a period where the warriors and the merchant work in symbiosis, the warriors expanding and forging new trade routes for the merchants. And in the case of the British Empire, this was explicit. It's almost laughable how explicit it is at times, you know. Hello, my name's Cecil. I'd like to set up a trading post. And then a few years later, here's the army, by the way, and all of this is ours now. You know, that's kind of British Empire style. Glubb calls that period the high noon, where you get the remnants of an old warrior caste working hand in hand with a merchant caste that is producing prosperity at the same time. But prosperity brings about, dun, 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 intellectuals again, who come for a second time, only this time not as priests, but instead, rather than erecting the imperial altar, they're seeking to tear it down this time. And this sort of situation of the deconstructionist intellectuals this time tearing down the empire can only be arrested by the coming of a Caesar, a kind of people's champion who embodies the wishes and hopes of the peasantry in himself. So where the lion archetype predominates, either as monarchism, that's the warriors, or as Caesarism, that's the peasants, civilizational successes can be held in check for a period. They tend to create strong regimes through ruthlessness, but such strength, ironically, leads to the managerial need for administration generated by growth and complexity, which in turn leads to the rise of elites of the fox archetype taking over again. And you can actually see, again, I mean, I use the Mongols because I think they're a really easy kind of example, but Glubb gives examples of these literally illiterate Khans standing there with a clerk behind him who was just like thrown a bit of food, like that's how much they were dismissed. But that clerk, in that case, a Persian one, was basically running the show. He was like a kind of James Burnham of his day. And it's like, hold on a second. We can't read or write, and we've let this dude collect all our taxes. So you can see what happens again and again and again in history. And one of the issues with a lion type is that it can never maintain for long, owing to this earlier point. Civilizational successes lead to their own loss conditions. Nothing lasts forever. Things can be held in abeyance only for temporary periods. And the sixth point, on the fox archetype, when the fox archetype predominates, either as theocracy, That's when you get your priests or your intellectuals running things. Or as a plutarchy, they're your merchants. Civilizational success may accelerate, but in the process, the very foundations that facilitated such success in the first place are eroded, eventually leading to collapse. You're all really familiar with this point because you've lived your whole lives in it. this is largely a rearticulation of what we've established already, but it's important to understand always that these effects are the function of the character and nature of the elites. The prophets of doom are all de facto elite theorists, and some of them had even read Pareto directly, in the case of Spengler and Evola and some others. They basically hold the lessons of elite theory as self-evident, and which is a kind of happy accident that I didn't know would be as marked until I finished the book. In the interest of time, I'm going to skip on. Seven, quantity has a quality all of its own, which manifests as all that is mass, democracy, utilitarianism, standardization, and the destruction of quality and distinction. This is a feature of late pre-collapse cycle. Now, when people talk about entropy, which is the theme of this event, it is generally something like this they're talking about. The reign of quantity is a direct assault on all that is distinctive and qualitative. Its effects are always flattening, always downwards, always to the mediocre level of the mean. And I was given a profound real-life example of this when I decided to stop off at the services somewhere in the Midlands on my way here and had to queue up with all the other castle waiting for my lunch. A service station really is kind of mind, soul-numbing place. Anyway, number seven, individuals of one civilizational season cannot embody the spirit of another. The children of the winter, for example, cannot embody the spring. Now, this should be self-evident, but it bears repeating. It doesn't matter how much you puff yourself up. It doesn't matter how many of the mindfulness exercises Maven was talking about earlier on, or meditations you do. You are a child of winter. You are not Genghis Khan. Now, this process cannot be cheated. This is important. Process cannot be cheated. The great man, the Carlylean great man, will come when the conditions are right. And a prerequisite for producing the Carlylean great man is always some sort of struggling or suffering or something like that. Now, it's weird, like it's possible, for example, that the humiliation of the mugshot will somehow like make Trump like a great man. I doubt it, but this is we're getting closer to some sort of actual suffering there. I don't mean suffering like I got fired from my job over an edgy tweet sort of suffering. I mean, you know, I have lived in the mountains and, you know, survived in the desert eating only squirrels for 10 years, you know. And again, have a look at some of the background, like have a look at the actual life of Genghis Khan as an example. Or even of like, if you want to bring it closer to like, look at the Bolsheviks and the years of struggle they had before they actually achieved power, or the mid-century Germans, for example, had suffered not only national humiliations, they'd served in World War I as well. So what I'm saying is you can't just jump from playing on a Game Boy to Genghis Khan. It's just not going to happen. And ninth. Civilization is incommunicable. The world feeling of a people, as Spengler says, is not transferable. This is a direct quotation from Spengler. What one people takes over from another in conversion or in admiring feeling is a name, dress, and mask for its own feeling, never the feeling of that other. Okay? Doesn't matter how much Justin Trudeau dresses up. I mean, As with historical period, so too with civilizations. And this is one of the most important lessons in the book, and the one I think that many people will resist the most stubbornly for one reason or another, in spite of all of the evidence to the contrary. For the past year or so, every couple of weeks, I have shared a video on my Twitter feed, OG Roland Rat, follow him now, where essentially the video will have some member of a civilizational outgroup in America or in Europe showing the eternal truth of this claim from Gobineau and from Spengler. And most of the time, all I add to these tweets are, civilization is incommunicable. In other words, Rishi Sunak does not have resting British face, as someone claimed recently. He is wearing borrowed clothes, and everybody in the entire world knows it. And 10th, ethnicity is a constant reality which promotes in-group solidarity in the early cycle and which becomes a problem for the ruling class to manage in the late cycle. Now, this is probably the one point I don't need to elaborate on for all of the people in this room, so we'll move on from that one. Okay, so these 10 conclusions are deeply at odds with how people have tended to think about history in the past few decades, and they contradict almost in every respect the worldview that has predominated since 1945. Yet, despite this fact, evidence for all 10 points are all around us. The church, which preaches peace, diversity, equality, and inclusion, some of them even quite literally flying a pride flag, aka the imperial altar, is not the same as the church that embarked on the Crusades, which is the spark. And in fact, this is another reoccurring theme, which is that what we call Western civilization, the spark for it, starts with the Crusades. This is how Spengler, Faustian man starts at that moment in history. Conquest, wealth, and education have failed utterly to solve the sorts of maladies that some of the prophets of doom were discussing over 100 years ago. On the contrary, they have accelerated them. Decades of deconstruction and cultural critique have weakened even the remnants of the already much weakened social bonds that held the edifice of Western civilization together during the time of Carlyle. Everywhere, the fox archetype rules through cunning and persuasion, although its tricks look ever more transparent and cruder as the quality of elites has degraded. Quality and distinction are increasingly all but outlawed in a stultifying, standardized world that, despite crowing ever more loudly about diversity, seems to flatten and deaden anything uniquely local and particular under the leaden foot of globalism, once dubbed muck world. Even as millions of people look on in horror as the social order they have known all their lives seems to collapse all around them, even as, in the case of Brazil in early 2023, millions flood the street, practically begging for a great man to grab history by the scruff of the neck, none dare step forward. The children of late winter cannot embody the spring, and nothing says this more than the sorry image of former Brazilian president Bolsonaro sitting down to enjoy a KFC miles away from crowds he led on and then abandoned. I didn't make that up. That actually happened. Millions of people were in the streets and he took a selfie with a KFC. Do you remember that? Bolsonaro is a child of late winter. He was made to eat KFC and not play Caesar. Western leaders simply ignore the grim on-the-ground realities of multiculturalism, whether it is mass grooming gangs in the UK, fire in the streets of Paris, out-of-control crime in American cities. The political class bury their ostrich heads in the sand and pretend there is no qualitative difference between peoples. Won't somebody think of the curry houses? whether it is Atlanta, London, or Islamabad, their dream in the end is of a giant, sprawling Milton Keynes with convenient parking and a Starbucks. Now, before closing, I want to touch on four different issues that arise out of the preceding discussion. I mean, of the whole book, but also the one we've had today. Three from Brooks Adams and one from Spengler. Now, as I outlined in the chapter on Brooks Adams, he believed that the modern age may represent the end of cyclical history. And in fact, this is a bridge actually back to Aaron's talk, because Brooks Adams had similar ideas. He thought essentially that Faustian man had broken history. Peter Turchin notably restricts his analysis to the agrarian age and does not range beyond 1900. So he stops his analysis in 1900 and has nothing to say about the modern world. Let us recall the three reasons that Adams gave for his belief that the cycles would end. First, he argued that modern technology and policing methods put elites beyond attack. Second, he believed that since the world has been effectively colonized, there are no more barbarians to supply fresh energy. Third, he believed that since capitalism was now truly global, Asia would eclipse Europe in the long run owing to their cheaper labor and faster birth rates. Now, bear in mind, he was writing in the 19th century, so it's pretty long-sighted. He was, threw a dart through history and landed somewhere around now. Now, Spengler predicts a period of Caesarism which tames what he calls the money power. However, it is not clear if this period is in fact already over with the Second World War and the fall of the Berlin Wall representing the last defeats of the Caesars. In other words, has the money power won indefinitely, and are there prospects for more Caesarism in the future? Spengler does have like a doomsday, like 1,000-year Reich kind of, but not that Reich. I mean, the 1,000-year muck world, you know. It's 1,000 years we're still watching Netflix and drinking Starbucks in 3010, you know. I will address each of these in turn, if I've got time. The idea that the elites are now untouchable because of technology is highlighted most memorably by the large barbed wire fence that was erected around Washington following the election of Joe Biden as US president. Do you remember that? And this election was disputed and labeled as fraudulent by the incumbent, Donald Trump. Now, whether Biden really received 81 million votes in 2020, he didn't. He did. I support Rishi Sunak in all his ways. So whether Biden really did receive 81 million votes in 2020 is less relevant than the fact that the idea of American leaders being put in physical jeopardy was highlighted by the iconography of the fences and the media kind of fuss around over the so-called insurrection on the 6th of January 2021. On the 30th of August 2022, Joe Biden made a barely veiled threat to his political opponents, which again evoked the idea of a violent clash between the government and the 74 million Americans who voted for Trump. This is a direct quote from Joe Biden. "For those brave right-wing Americans who say the Second Amendment is all about keeping America independent and safe, if you want to fight against the country, you need an F-15. You need something a little more than a gun." No. That's real. I didn't make that up. It's kind of remarkable. I think this was the blood speech, right? I mean, if it had been one of ours, I would have been like, that's based. But because it was Joe Biden, that's really scary. This led to a widespread debate, which amounted to a real-life discussion of Brooks Adams' point. Does technology put elites beyond the threat of physical reproach? Now, without getting into the technicalities of imagining guerrilla fighters in MAGA hats armed with machine guns up against F-15 fighter jets, Otherwise, it'd be quite fun to watch. without imagining that, the answer comes down in the end, not to technology, but as it has always done in history, to will, on what Turchin calls asabaya, the collective solidarity, especially the collective solidarity between elites. If it came down to it, do the American elites have the will to use force on large swathes of the population? In Pareto's terms, this would signal a shift from a fox-led soft managerial regime that relies on persuasion to a lion-led hard managerial regime that relies on force. And even then, when a regime becomes openly coercive, the need for their number to remain determined to stay in power and above all else unified is even greater. Since Adams was writing, we have seen at least one enormous modern state, the USSR, collapse, and many smaller states in the Eastern Bloc, everybody forgets about those, they also collapsed. Despite enjoying modern policing methods and technologies. Also, the 1979 revolution in Iran was also a modern state by any standard, which underwent circulation of elites. Therefore, we can only conclude that other modern states, such as the USA or China, might also fall. Next, Adams argues that there can be no more barbarians, basically because the world has discovered we're out of barbarians, like where they're going to come from, right? Let us first be clear what we are looking for, okay? Recall the distinction Toynbee made between mere barbarians. So Toynbee has a distinction between these barbarians who come as the spark, Genghis Khan type, and mere barbarians who are basically like carrion that feast on a empire that's collapsed. Like many of the ones who come after the collapse of the Roman Empire, they're just there to loot and pillage and so on. They're not starters of a spark. They're just mere barbarians. Okay, we're looking for the second type of barbarians to kick off a new cycle. And, you know, we saw the Macedonians, the Arabs who followed Muhammad, the Mongols, the Mamluks, and so on and so forth. Now, Toynbee also provides a model of what he calls withdrawal and return, later refined and made much more elegant by Peter Turchin's meta-ethnic frontier theory, is what he calls it. But it's essentially like updated Toynbee, which accounts for how do such tightly knit groups who trigger the spark come about in the first place? Basically, they live out in the mountains or in the desert on the frontiers of a great empire. And then when it's collapsed, they burst forth. Okay. They are incubated by relatively hostile conditions behind frontiers, which produce asabaya. We have witnessed in very recent history the Taliban recapture Afghanistan from the USA. So there's your kind of direct instance of this. Mountain and desert militias, paramilitary groups, and private military contractors all still exist. Africa has many warlords. North Korea has survived as a hermit state. More complicated arguments may be made for various South American groups, especially in quasi-autonomous regions run by cartels to provide a spark. Got this kind of bizarre scenario where the new spark is generated by, like, forget the name of that gang now. They're not bringing their best. Like they could, it could be them, you know. yet more complicated arguments still can be made for the African-American population who have long faced a series of struggles that has provided a feeling of asabaya in what many members of the black community see as a hostile environment. I am here suggesting that growing up in the hood is a little bit like being like surviving in the desert or the jungle or something. I mean, it's like a jungle out there. Do you remember? I was Grandmaster Flash. The frontiers of the hood or the concrete jungle are very well documented in African-American subcultures, which was my polite way in the book of saying that. What is key to remember is that in almost every case, the group that triggers the spark arrives in a post-collapse environment. It would be a mistake to imagine any of the groups I have listed as potentials to light such a spark taking on the US military, but rather to imagine conditions after the collapse of Western states. Okay, so you're not, it's not like any of these groups are going to raise a militia and then they're going to take on the army. It's more the collapse comes about and these guys take over afterwards. That's usually how it happens. I mean, not always. Like, there are some cases where they directly conquer the those Arabs I mentioned, the ones in 600 AD, they conquered the Persians. Adams' next claim that capitalism is now global and that production would inevitably shift to China and Asia more widely is undoubtedly true. However, as we have seen, success breeds its own lost conditions. If the East becomes dominant over the West for a period, it too will face decline. It too will face the inevitable effects of luxury, wealth, and so on. And in the case of the Chinese, they keep on driving up the price of my Cuban cigar, so it's already happening. If conditions then become harsher in Europe and in America, the asabaya will increase and new reservoirs of spirit may be found. So you see how this weird process works, where if the Chinese somehow have like a century of dominance, the suffering that we will be under will then, you know, your great grandkids will be leading crusades or something. I don't know. So this may be counterintuitive, but there is a civilizational mechanism by which winning for a period almost invariably means losing for a period. So the saying goes, hard times create strong men create good times create weak men create hard times. While, as we have seen, there is a lot more to cyclical history than this oft-repeated meme, there is also an essential truth to it. However, this does not change the fact that the Malthusian trap on which Turchin's model rests has been broken. Thus, it is not clear if population growth leads inextricably to the same breakdown and eventual collapse that he describes. China and India each have over a billion people, and their respective states do not seem to be under any immediate threat of collapsing, unless you listen to Peter Zahn, in which case it's going to collapse next year. Capitalism is also now global, such that capital can be shifted around the globe at the touch of a button. The elites are no longer simply governments, but a mobile anywhere globalist class who might base themselves in any given city. This book began with just one such elite, former British Prime Minister Tony Blair. Whether states still have the power to rein in capital using force is an open question. It is the question Vladimir Putin asked the world when he launched his offensive into Ukraine. In the case of China, still under the rule of the Chinese Communist Party and the increasingly autocratic Xi Jinping, the state quite clearly still rules over the money power. However, both states inextricably depend on global trade for their survival. Only the future can tell if the current power of global capital, as represented by the Davos class, can be overcome. Now, I don't know how much longer we've got here, but rather than carry on reading this, I'm wondering if it's good to take some questions in the interest of time. So let us, you can clap for a small period and then...
If you like this video, be sure to like and subscribe. You can join the channel for thousands of hours of past shows in the archive and hundreds of videos. If you have any questions, you can leave a super chat or a super thanks, and I'll be sure to pick it up during my weekly office hours, which run every Tuesday afternoon. I also provide courses at the academic agency, which I encourage people to buy. Thousands of students now have taken the Trivium to improve their skills in writing, logic, and rhetoric. Just three of many courses available. Buy it now. But most importantly of all, friends, get out.